Exodus 20 and verse 5. I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. The meaning here is the same as if he had said that our duty is to cleave to him alone, as the first command says. To induce us to this, he proclaims his authority, which he will not permit to be impaired or despised with impunity. It is true the word used is El, which means God, but as it is derived from a word meaning strength. He also calls himself jealous, because he cannot bear a partner. And he declares that he will vindicate his majesty and glory if any transfer it either to creatures or to graven images, and that not by a simple punishment of a brief duration, but one extending to the third and the fourth generation of such as imitate the impiety of their progenitors. In the same manner, he declares his constant mercy and kindness to the remote posterity of those who love him and keep his law. The Lord very frequently addresses us in the character of a husband, the union by which he connects us with himself, when he receives us into the heart of the church, having some resemblance of that holy wedlock because it's founded on mutual faith. And as he performs all the offices of a true and faithful husband, so he stipulates love and conjugal chastity from us. That is, that we do not prostitute our souls to Satan to be defiled with foul, carnal lusts. So when he rebukes the Jews for their apostasy, he complains that they have cast off chastity and polluted themselves with adultery. Therefore, as the pure and more chaste the husband is, the more grievously he is offended when he sees his wife inclining to a rival. So the Lord, who has betrothed us to himself in truth, declares that he burns with the hottest jealousy whenever, neglecting the purity of his holy marriage, we defile ourselves with abominable lusts, and especially when the worship of his deity, which ought to have been most carefully kept unimpaired, is transferred to another, or adulterated with some superstition. Since in this way we not only violate our fidelity, but defile the nuptial couch by giving access to adulterers. In the threatening, we must attend to what is meant when God declares that he will visit the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation. It seems inconsistent with the equity of the divine procedure to punish the innocent for another's fault. The Lord himself declares that the son shall not bear the iniquity of the father, Ezekiel 18:20. But still, we meet more than once with a declaration as to the postponing of punishment of the sins of the fathers to future generations. In this way, Moses repeatedly addresses the Lord as visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation, Numbers 14:18. In like manner, Jeremiah, thou showest loving kindness unto thousands, and recompenses the iniquity of the fathers into the bosom of their children after them, Jeremiah 32:18. Some, feeling sadly perplexed how to solve this difficulty, think it's to be understood of temporal punishments only, which it is said sons may properly bear for the sins of their parents because they are often inflicted for their own safety. This is indeed true, for Isaiah declared to Hezekiah that his children should be stripped of the kingdom and carried away in captivity for a sin which he had committed, Isaiah 39:7. And the households of Pharaoh and Abimelech were made to suffer an injury done to Abraham, Genesis 12:17 and Genesis 20:3-18. But the attempt to solve the question in this way is an evasion rather than a true interpretation. For the punishment denounced here and in similar passages is too great to be confined within the limits of the present life. We must therefore understand it to mean that a curse from the Lord righteously falls not only on the head of the guilty individual, but also on his lineage. When it has fallen, what can be anticipated but that the father, being deprived of the Spirit of God, will live most terribly? That the son, being in the same manner forsaken of the Lord because of his father's iniquity, will follow the same road to destruction and be followed in his turn by succeeding generations, forming a seed of evildoers. Why is this? The doctrine tells us. God is jealous for his character against all evildoers. First, let us examine whether such punishment is inconsistent with divine justice. If human nature is universally condemned, those on whom the Lord does not bestow the communication of his grace must be doomed to destruction. Nevertheless, they perish by their own iniquity, not by unjust hatred on the part of God. There is no room to expostulate and ask why the grace of God does not forward their salvation as it does of others. Therefore, when God punishes the wicked for their crimes by depriving their families of his grace for many generations, who will dare bring a charge against him for this most righteous vengeance? But it will be said, the Lord, on the contrary, declares that the Son shall not suffer of the Father's sin. Ezekiel 18:20. But observe the scope of the passage. The Israelites, after being subjected to a long period of uninterrupted calamities, had begun to say, as a proverb, that their fathers had eaten the sour grape and thus set the children's teeth on edge, meaning that they, though in themselves righteous and innocent, were paying the penalty of sins committed by their parents, and this more from the implacable anger that the Lord duly tempered in severity from God. The prophet declares it was not so, that they were punished for their own wickedness, that it was not in accordance with the justice of God that a righteous son should suffer for the iniquity of a wicked father, and that nothing of the kind was exemplified in what they suffered. For if the visitation of which we now speak is accomplished, when God withdraws from the children of the wicked in light of his truth, and other helps to salvation, the only way in which they are accused for their father's wickedness is in being blinded and abandoned by God, and so left to walk in their parents' steps. The misery which they suffer in time and the destruction to which they are finally doomed are in this way punishments inflicted by divine justice, not for the sins of others, but for their own iniquity. On the other hand, there is a promise of mercy to thousands, a promise which is frequently mentioned in Scripture and forms an article in the solemn covenant made with the church. I will be a God unto thee and to thy seed after thee, Genesis 17:7. But with reference to this, Solomon says, the just man walketh in his integrity. His children are blessed after him, Proverbs 20 and verse 7. Not only in consequence of a religious education, though this certainly is by no means unimportant, but in consequence of the blessing promised in the covenant, in other words, that the divine favor will dwell forever in the families of the righteous. And this is excellent consolation to believers, and great ground of terror to the wicked. For if after death the mere remembrance of righteousness and iniquity have such an influence on the divine procedure that his blessings rest on the posterity of the righteous and his curse on the posterity of the wicked, much more must it rest on the heads of the individuals themselves. Notwithstanding of this, however, the offspring of the wicked sometimes amends, while that of believers degenerates, because the Almighty has not here laid down an inflexible rule which might derogate from his free election. For the consolation of the righteous and the dismay of the sinner, it's enough that the threatening itself is not vain or nugatory, although it does not always take effect. For as the temporal punishments inflicted on a few of the wicked are proofs of the divine wrath against sin and of the future judgment that will ultimately overtake all sinners, though many escape with impunity even to the end of their lives, so when the Lord gives one example of a blessing, a son for his father's sake, by visiting him in mercy and kindness, it is a proof of constant and unfailing favor to his worshipers. But on the other hand, when in any single instance he visits the iniquity of the father on the son, he gives intimation of the judgment which awaits all the reprobate for their own iniquities. The certainty of this is the principal thing here taught. Moreover, the Lord, as it were, by the way, commends the riches of his mercy by extending it to thousands, while he limits his vengeance to four generations. The knowledge of God does not consist in frigid speculation, but carries worship along with it. In other words, how God is duly worshipped. Now, I will say that whenever Scripture asserts the unity of God, it does not contend for a mere name, but also enjoins that nothing which belongs to divinity be applied to any other, in this way making it obvious in what respect pure religion differs from superstition. Right worship is a certain rule to be observed in order that God might not be worshipped absurdly. God, in vindicating his own right, first proclaims that he is a jealous God and will be a stern avenger if he is confounded with any false god, and therefore defines what due worship is in order that the human race may be kept in obedience. Both of these he embraces in his law, when he first binds the faithful in allegiance to him as their only lawgiver, and then prescribes a rule for worshiping him in accordance with his will. The law, with its manifold uses and object, is designed as a bridle to curb men and prevent them from turning aside to spurious worship. Unless everything peculiar to divinity is confined to God alone, he is robbed of his honor and his worship is violated. Consider then the worship of the living God. It may be proper here more particularly to attend the subtleties which superstition employs. In revolting to strange gods, it avoids the appearance of abandoning the supreme God, or what belongs to God in worship is to be kept unimpaired. They give worship to God and give service to others. When Paul reminds the Galatians of what they were before they came to the knowledge of God, he says that they, quote, did service unto them by which nature are no gods. Galatians 4:8. Because he does not say latria, was their superstition excusable? This superstition to which he gives the name of dulia, he condemns as much as if he had given it the name of latria. When Christ repels Satan's insulting proposal with the words, "It is written, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve," Matthew 4:10, there was no question of latria. For all that Satan asked was respect. In the same manner, when John is rebuked by the angel for falling on his knees before him, Revelation 19:10 and 22:8 and 9, we ought not to suppose that John had so far forgotten himself as to have intended to transfer the honor of that was due to God alone to an angel. But because it was impossible that a worship connected with religion should not savor something of divine worship, he could not do obeisance to the angel without derogating from the glory of God. To do it to one is to dishonor the other. True, we often read that men were worshipped, but that was, if I may say so, speak civil honor. The case is different with religious honor, which the moment it is conjoined with worship carries profanation of the divine honor along with it. The same may be seen in the case of Cornelius, Act 10:25. He had not made so little progress in piety as not to confine supreme worship to God alone. Therefore, when he prostrates himself before Peter, he certainly does not with the intention of adoring him instead of God. Yet Peter sternly forbids him. Why? But just because men never distinguish so accurately between the worship of God and the creatures as not to transfer promiscuously to the creature that which belongs only to the jealous God. Therefore, if we would have one God, let us remember that we can never appropriate the minutest portion of his glory without retaining what is his due. Accordingly, when Zechariah discourses concerning the repairing of the church, he distinctly says not only that there would be one God, but also that he would have only one name. The reason being that he might have nothing in common with idols. He's been pleased to prescribe in his law what is lawful and right, and in this way restrict men to a certain rule, lest any should allow themselves to devise a worship of their own because he is a jealous God. Remember that whatever offices of piety are bestowed anywhere else on God alone, they then are of the nature of sacrilege. Superstition attached divine honors to the sun and the stars or to idols. Afterwards, ambition followed. Ambition which, decking man in the spoils of God, dared to profane all that was sacred. And though the principle of worshiping a supreme deity continued to be held, still the practice was to sacrifice promiscuously to genies and minor gods or departed heroes. So prone is the descent of this vice of communicating to a crowd that which God strictly claims as his own particular right. And the reason is that he is the most jealous God, jealous for his character, jealous for his worship, jealous for those things that are due to him alone.